Hello, yes. AstraZeneca and Sambuca. Boo, 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 ca, ca. I will be having the vaccine today. I'll be having the vaccine at 2:30, the first one at least. And I had a it was an ethical quandary, I suppose. It's an ethical quandary in that. I felt, is there more, is there a better candidate than me? I'm only doing maximum 15 hours of care per week now. Do 5 hour night shifts where, or evening shifts where help a 30-year-old with severe learning difficulties. So he's got the sort of mental capacity of an inquisitive, thoughtful 5-year-old. I mean, the conversation is limited. The conversation is very slight. It's we have a but it's good. We've actually cultivated a shared stock of references and jokes that he got a good response from. Like a kid, he got a good response from once, so he repeats them ad nauseum. But I give him the same reaction each time. So that's all he's asking for. And he'll do a joke about Danny eat Liam dinner. That's me, Pope. We'll say Pope. Danny eat Pope dinner. What will Pope have? Pope have Danny apple. So Danny's gonna eat my dinner, and in return, I'm gonna have his apple. And I always go, ah, that's not a fair swap. I'm gonna have your apple. Oh no, come on. Not a fair swap. Doesn't sound like a fair swap to me, Danny. Finds it very funny. Then I go, no, Danny have half an apple and Liam have four dinners. And Danny laughs at that. I go, Liam also have Nikki dinner and Sandra's dinner. And then Sandra go, no, you bloody will not. Oh, his son go, you don't bloody have my dinner. He's not, hell, he's not having my bloody dinner. I go, no, I'm just joking, Sandra. And she, oh, right, okay. Did you see the painting? I don't know if any of you saw the painting Nikki done for me on of a car. It's lovely. On she's really excited about doing it. So I bought her a Formula One hat. She loves Formula One. I just that this is how the sort of lack of stimulation that these poor people get is that she's got a in July got an assessment. It's a I don't know if it's a yearly assessment or maybe a quarterly assessment or something like that. Basically, they just ask you a few questions, probably social services, maybe or just mental capacity people. Ask her a few questions is fucking hell, not one of them. No, I don't mean that. They just ask her a few questions about her, like her well-being, what kind of activities she's been up to, if she has any complaints or concerns, how she's feeling in and of herself. Just a rundown, just a check-in. She's truly, truly excited about this. She's really, really excited about this assessment. Won't stop going on about it. All she had to look forward to. So I get them like little presents. I've got her a Formula One hat, which she loved, and she'd done me this brilliant painting. Well, she'd done me a painting of a car. And when she had it to me, she said, "You're 31 now. You better learn to drive soon." And I want to go, "Yeah, well, you're 72, and look at the fucking state of this painting, love." So, if you want to get a little bit, if you want to lock horns with me, you better back down soon enough because I will cut, and I will bite, and I will spit. This painting is bullshit, and I'm offended. I'm offended that you did it for me. I'm offended that you did it to me, and that I had to endure this painting is something that's been done to me now because it's so fucking shit and aesthetically displeasing. I'm offended that you did that to me and expected me to enjoy it. Couldn't even tell what it was. Couldn't even tell where it was. If you didn't say about the car, I would not have known. I'd not have known. And that wasn't intentional. This wasn't abstract art. That's supposed to be a very technically rendered car in your mind. You in yourself look like how you would draw normal people. I'm joking. Oh, mate, I'm joking. I'm so joking. I really am. She's like lovely. I love them all to bits. I'm doing it to. There's something quite liberating about joking about cruel things, but knowing that my listeners or my audience understand the motivation behind it, and no, I'm not really a cruel person. But maybe that's part of it. Feeling like you can get away, feeling like you can say this stuff and get away with it, and there's no consequences. And I mean, this will probably come back to bite me in the ass at some point, especially when you start raising your profile and people are out to tear it down a little bit. I don't think I'll get to that point. I don't think I'll get to that point where people there's like a campaign of aggrieved people. You know, there's not many aggrieved people in my life. I'm quite a lonely person. Keep myself to myself, have a laugh with people. Been a bit of a dick before. Apologise for it, you know. Like my good friend Davina, because she's just like, my sister, I knock her about. We not physically knock her about, but like there's a camaraderie between us that's a bit rough and tumble. But then it's fine when it's reciprocated, then when it's something that we're doing amongst each other. But there's been times where I've gone on a podcast and spoke about how she made me very class conscious, very working class. She made me feel what I am. And then I spoke about, you know, this kind of laddish chest forward way, said about that when we first started, met each other and were like a little bit flirtatious, that she wanted to sleep with me when that wasn't the case at all. I wasn't on the cards. I wanted to date her or go on a date with her. I'm really glad we didn't now, because she's become such a solid friend. I love her to bits. And if we had started dating, I don't think that would have worked. I think there would have been a clash of personalities, and we probably wouldn't have stayed in contact. But yeah, like, that just sort of laddie sense of entitlement of like, say, oh, of course you wanted to sleep with me, which I don't usually speak like that. It's not, if I do, it's in a way of like, it's holding a mirror up to sexism, and it's ironic kind of piggishness. But then am I just saying that to excuse myself of indulging that piggish part of my personality, which is probably more to the point. And Davina rightfully felt kind of like hurt by that, and I suppose maybe a bit undermined and embarrassed, complete justified response that I was a dickhead for doing that. So I've done faultless things like that. I like to be very upfront about my thoughts and behaviour, full disclosure, complete transparency. The confessional is a big part of recovery program of 12 steps, and I think people warm to you when they know there isn't that kind of masquerade, when they know it's a kind of direct transmission from your id, that what you're saying, you're a transparent person. even if you know you say, but you can add an addendum or a caveat or whatever. Like when you say stuff, you can go, look, I know this is bad. Like me joking about people with learning difficulties. That's bad and wrong. Probably you assume that we're like, this is like a close knit listenership that like it won't leak beyond the walls of this confined world of us. Then there's listeners out there who may A, have learning difficulties, or B, have loved ones who have learning difficulties and might, that will snag. It could ruin someone's day. Then that's when I say, you know, sometimes there's a need to be a human, relinquish the opportunity to make a joke and do a like a cost benefit analysis. Work out, is the joke really worth the collateral of upsetting someone? Most of the time, no. But then I don't know. Anyway. So I'm going to read out a bit of what I've been writing about. But it's sort of been rehab. Do you like these little bits of? I don't even know if they'll make it into the book. It's just an in you know get a little taste of what the book's going to be about. I hope you feel very privileged, right? Get a backstage look behind the curtain ahead of time, ahead of schedule. So one delusion or excuse I did allow myself is the false justification that opiates improved my writing and performing. In an essay about Robert Stone and his novel Dog Soldiers, Thomas Powers writes, Marge Hicks, one of the novel's protagonists, is smart and medicates her boredom with Percodan and Dilaudid. So I think Percodan is oxycontin or oxycodone, and Dilaudid is hypermorphone, I think. She has never seriously tried to quit opioids and has no idea what that might be like. In her view, a weakness for drugs, just a biological detail, like red hair or gluten intolerance, not something she needs to think about. There's actually a lot of science, a book called Never Enough, The Neuroscience of Addiction, that confirm this view of having been genetically predisposed and just your brain, even if it was just a behavioral or habitual thing, your brain eventually being rewired in a way that makes you an addict. Go back. Banging on about addiction, I talk about it on that episode. Go back to that episode. It's a good one. Actually, if we're going to go, so I think this might actually be my last season of this podcast. I think it might be my last season, depending. I don't know. The response has been amazing so far. We're now on 7,300 listens. Overall listens, which is, you know, by some standards, that's measly, it's meager, but I've that's fucking great. That's great. I'm thankful for every single one of you who's, even the ones of you who have tried it and said, not for me, not going to continue this, gave it a go. I love you as well, but you won't know because you dropped it because you're unloyal. You won't know. You won't be listening to this episode because you've got no sense of loyalty and comradeship. You're not fit for the IRA. Us boys of the IRA, all about loyalty, all about comradeship, and all about Semtex. Semtex. Make a condom out of Semtex. Blows up your dick. IRA. Why was I talking about the IRA? What the fuck is I talking about the IRA for? What's his name? The one in May's prison. Bobby Sands. That's it. Bobby Sands. Reading a book about the hunger strikers and the in the Maze prison, and Bobby Sands obviously was one of them. Became an MP during it. The thing is, I understand the crusade, the mission behind republicanism. I actually probably agree with it, but it's the methods in which to instill fear into a larger body that you feel under the thumb of, and you know, you feel imprisoned by the English. But just chill out. Got a fucking botany garden in Belfast. What kind of prison has that? Got a big, a lovely botany. Is it Botany Garden? What's it called? You got public gardens. Belfast. I went to a restaurant that had had a nice bit of lamb there. You don't get that in a prison. You don't get that in a prison. You can get a bus there. You can take buses from there to elsewhere. You don't do that in a prison. But yeah, you know, I understand. I understand. It's hard. I understand the hardship. Kind of like start reading books about ISIS and how humanitarian intervention, you can't bomb freedom and democracy into other countries if they're countries that don't want it. They're fundamentally opposed to. We can't try and force our worldview. We can't assume the primacy of our way of life and try and force it onto other people. And if you're trying to force it onto other regions and they get a bit beheady, you only yourself to blame, and the beheader who's going, itchy trigger finger, shouldn't have done that, don't cut off heads, symbolically. Understand it, so it's a good symbol, cutting off a head. I mean, I'd hate to be parted with mine. I'd hate it. It's a controversial opinion, but I'm going to say it now, I'm going to say it loud. I would hate to be parted with my head. I would not enjoy it even for a moment. If I was parted with my head, it'd be one of the top three things that's ever happened to me. It'd be horrible to get beheaded. And that's my take on that. And this is what you're coming for. You're coming for Pope's hot takes. Pope's hot takes. Pope's lukewarm tits. But yeah, violence begets violence. Eye for an eye. Don't agree with that, but that's what happens. It's a causation. You get people amped up by just telling them what to do. Stop telling me what to do. Give me that head. Give me your head. Pass it over. Give it to me. Yes, thank you. You'll have that back at the end of the day. All right. Why we're polarized by Ezra Klein. Oh no, I was reading some more of my thing. Yeah, we'll read that first. I'll get past. I think we've read that before. So apparently they always. So my therapist helpfully pointed out during our daily group sessions in a small homely room with padded armchairs in a circle that I hadn't written anything for a year, hadn't gigged in 5 months, but newly clean and in rehab, I was producing extensive daily diaries. Apparently, they always looked forward to reading them. They're like a novella. Though one of my early cogs, which was change of goals, was don't over-intellectualize everything or use humor as a diversionary tactic. These tics could obstruct my ability to drill into my emotional core. Yep, definitely accurate. When my nanny Vera died, I told my mum I was going to use my nan's corpse as a toboggan. which was just a fun way of saying that we're recycling Nan. She still has some use. What we have to do is just bend the arms up and around, and then you've got the loops that you bend the legs up for wind resistance. You don't get any drag. Or you do get drag. I've not done Dead Nan tobogganing before, so it's all new to me. It's all new to me. I've still got to read the instruction manuals. But I did. I joked about that to very little acclaim. Very, very little positive feedback from my mum. Gave me a one star. Gave me a one star for that. It's like, in the words of Roland Barthes, the uneasiness that he rediscovered when his mum passed away, being a subject torn between two languages, one expressive, the other critical. One expressive, the other critical. So those who, where there's an emotional drive, an emotionality behind what they're talking about, and the others who are more critical, right brain thinkers, lateral thinkers, so they think. This is what my mate Michael said, and that the reason people get so seduced by conspiracy theories, when they're mainly people who complexity doesn't quite agree with them. Complexity gives them the shits. But it has the appearance of critical thinking when you look at conspiracy theories and stuff. It's actually very illogical thinking told in a logical, coherent way. When we know actually the most logical thing is for there to be, you know, a connection, overlap, some mirroring, shadowing between different entities, rather than all these entities being connected in some way. This unifying theory, that's what people are always looking for, unifying theory of everything. And in times of upheaval and the variegated chaos of the political situation, of world affairs, that's when people are constantly trying to fix a template and order these different events, order these different people, see that there's got to be like one overseer that it all goes back to, but that's not the case. It's more complex than that. A lot of different variables, different shit going on. Stop trying to tie it all together, you fucking babies. Hey, what was the other book I was reading that was sort of touched upon that? Is it the book about the... No. Well, anyway. Probably got to find it. So being sort of Jason's expressiveness. Jason was a guy I was in rehab with. I've changed his name. He was a guy who was every proper, like, proper boy, tribal tattoos, etc. But was very adept at drilling down to his emotional core. Very raw. Very easy to... found it very easy to cry. And his raw emotion and my urge, to quote Roland Barthes, to exhibit an intellectual prowess. What good is flinging my brain about? As one of my therapists said, responding to these daily diaries, all you want to know is if you're sad, hungry, or horny. Maybe saying akin to an entry in a resident's daily obs record. So here's an example of that. Today, Gilbert ate well, drank plenty of fluids. He's been assisted with all personal care, including washing, dressing, and toileting, though He's encouraged to do things on his own when appropriate, e.g. washing his face with a flannel, doing up his buttons, cleaning his dentures. Rare, regular catheter care given. They please refer to the behavioural chart re-catheter baptism. Squeezed a big bag of piss over me. He's regularly interacting with people and participating in activities, but there's been occasional outbursts of anger or frustration. Not always apparent what's caused this. When it happens, I'll try to bring Gilbert into a quiet room or the garden and talk to him about his concerns. Cut to Pope is perched on the edge of a dining room table and Gilbert is in front of him in his wheelchair, gesticulating wildly. Gilbert, I see it all loud and clear. They've stolen four of my willies and all I get is this useless peanut. And guess what? This useless peanut sucked up my testicle again. And that was actually the actual excuse Gilbert once gave for yanking out his catheter. His sleeves were rolled up, his arms and hands covered in blood. He held up the bag, the latex tubes dangling down with drops of blood and urine falling to the floor. He'd mistaken the internal pressure caused by the catheter balloon for his bollock. He thought his knob had sucked up his bollock. A nice memory. The header reads on these daily diaries, ATP daily reflective diary, followed by a subheader. Please ensure that your completed diary is in the ATP postboxes in either Chelmer Ward or the Lodge by 8:30 a.m. I found the structure and routine of these daily diaries and the timekeeping that was expected of us, including when we arrived at group sessions or therapeutic activities, I found it to be beneficial. So once again, this, the thing that's so counterproductive in the midst of active addiction, but done right. Still, when does a routinized existence turn into institutionalization? It's a question I constantly wrestle with when thinking about care work. What's in the resident's best interest? Routine has a stabilizing effect. It reduces agitation and helps to imprint new information. What is a life without variety? Going by the standard of person-centered care, it will depend on the person. Anyway, underneath the headers, there's a brief instruction directive. Use this form to share what has been significant for you in treatment over the last 24 hours. As a guide, try to express your feelings as well as your thoughts about where you are presently on the program. And anything that you wish to share regarding your recovery. In notes made while falling, really good book, by the way. I'd recommend it by Jen Ashworth. I'll read out what I wrote about it on Twitter. See if it piques your interest. Okay. Just finding it. This is fun, isn't it? These bits. These are when I'm probably at my most unguarded. So if you actually asked me, anything in these moments, it'd be like a truth serum. But you can't ask me anything because I treat this like a dinner party where I'm the only one who's allowed to speak. Much like a man at every dinner party. Not that I've been to one, never been invited. Oh yeah, I've Lapland. Why weren't we people from Lapland? I told you about that. So just finish. So what I wrote about notes made while falling is very essayistic, erratic, tangential. Like a big part of it is about if the disruption or waywardness or something, or kind of breaking from the narrative thread or the crux of an argument. Divergence, that's what it was, divergence. By expertly mimics the disorder of traumatized thought process, except when it comes to the eidetic memory of the traumatic event itself. Really great book, would recommend. So if you go in, if you go into it knowing that it lacks coherence, but it, you know, is still utterly intelligible, like you can, you can read it and understand it, but as which this is the, this is the way my brain works and how I write, which is why it's very good to have an editor who can, who can you can neaten it up a bit. They rarely change the writing itself. It's the order in which the writing is delivered, because I've never wrote anything at this length, for starters. I've never wrote anything this long form. And I struggle to stay. I keep going off on tangents, which is, they want to keep that as well. So they really, they like that part of the book, but you've got to be economical about how much you do that. So in that, in the notes made while falling, she recounts her early years as a doctrinaire Mormon and the Mormon Church's tradition of record keeping and journaling. And this is from the Herbert. Accordingly, we urge our young people to begin to write and keep records of all the important things in their life. Stephen W. Kimball, 12th President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, says, Kimball is quick to define what is important and to list what belongs in a journal, which could be a private story of a life, a way of speaking and listening at the same time, and what does not. Your own private journal should record the way you face up to challenges that beset you, Kimball says. But success stories only, please. Personally, I have little respect for anyone who delves into the ugly phases of the life he is portraying, whether it be his own or another's. The truth should be told, but he should not emphasize the negative. Even a long life full of inspiring experiences can be brought to the dust by one ugly story. Why dwell on that one ugly truth about someone whose life has been largely circumspect? And then it's back to me. I couldn't disagree with this more. Personally, I think it's vital that we show the variegated chaos of human nature and don't deprive readers, whether God or future children or you suckers, of a biography with the gristle left on. Some people are abject because they are similarly expelled from the social body, writes Philip Skapansky in an essay entitled Addiction, Objection and Humour, Craig Ferguson's Confessional Stand-Up, and it's in a book, The Dark Side of Stand-Up Comedy. And they interviewed, it's a Palgrave Studies in Comedy book, it's brilliant, got a few different essays in there. Interviewed the editors behind it as part of a panel with Kiri Pritchard-McLean and the brilliant, incredible Andrew Hankinson, who wrote the book Don't Applaud, Either Laugh or Don't at the Comedy Cellar, about the free speech, well, about the Louis C.K. scandal and the importance of free speech within stand-up comedy. Look back at like Lenny Bruce trials and stuff. That would be a good kind of a foundational myth for a lot of people who now talk about free speech a lot. But I asked them people, please, I can think of 8, 9, 10 better examples in 1984 to illustrate your point. Just fine. If you want to fucking that, if you want to be a mouthpiece for liberty and freedom of speech, mainly because you realise you it's quite easy to monetize it at the moment, then so be it. But stop sticking your dick in Orwell. Jesus Christ, there's no surefire way to make me turn off is by low hanging fruit. That example, that's an obvious choice. Read more broadly. that's me being a snob, but a snob to people who themselves act as snobs. This category applies generally to people at the margins of society, including the homeless, mentally ill, and addicts. Great examples of the gristle that I'm talking about. And when people become symbolically connected to abjection, they're cut asunder and struggle to be fully integrated into the social body. But through confession or dwelling on the ugly truth, refusal to deny the unpalatable part of ourselves, kind of rebellion against the officialdom of social etiquette. This is all my stuff again. We're making it familiar. Once it's familiar, it's on its way to being rehabilitated. And if it's not totally accepted, it at least it deepens people's understanding. Why do you think I gravitate towards care work? More at home sitting with Gilbert, placing my hand on his shoulder and reassuring him that his testicle is where it should be, where it's always been. That's a good, loyal testicle. I'm more at home doing that than going to Nando's with my friends or attending a dinner party where they probably wouldn't want me or Gilbert there anyway. Cut to Pope and Gilbert around a refectory table with salubrious people dressed in formal wear. Gilbert clinks his glass. Pope gently taps him on the shoulder to dissuade him from speaking, which Gilbert disregards. He's his own man. Gilbert. Now, if anyone happens to see a bollock lying about, this obviously didn't happen. It's like a little flight of fancy. But I should question why I prefer chatting to a confused old man about bollock placement than going to Nando's or dinner parties. Bollock placement. It should be something else, shouldn't it? It should be the bollock. Bollock. Yeah, I'll have to think that up. Placement. I said not proximity. Confused old man about where. About where his bollock is will probably do. About where. Confused old man about where his bollock is. But back to my rehab diary. In the first entry, dated Tuesday, the 3rd of January 2016, it was actually 2017, but I put in the wrong date, wrong year, just to give you a sense of where my head was at. I wrote, I found the experience to be very cathartic so far. There was an automatic intimacy between me and the rest of the people in the ATP program. I felt uninhibited enough to share my thought processes, complete disclosure. Sometimes my initial instinct is to withdraw, to become cloistered, but I was open to the group. Physically, I've been agitated, and in between sessions, it was difficult to achieve any psychic tranquility. I read The Lonely Man of Faith by Joseph B. Soloveitchik, but was distracted by news events. I even get a narcotic effect off of the news cycle and daily updates about Trump. Anything that stimulate my brain. But I remember the infamous Steve Bannon Time cover came out then, so Time magazine there. There's been a few visual triggers today, e.g. noticing a pack of dihydrocodeine in the pharmacy. Even the colour scheme of the packet is a trigger. Even the sound of the blister pack, so that's an oral trigger. Ears. just so, it's like almost like I'm trying to explain to them, it's an oral trigger, so that's ears. Ears, yes. It reminds me of the ritual of drug abuse. Now, I'm slightly self-conscious. I'm using polished articulation to masquerade true, raw emotion during group sessions. I want people to think I'm funny and a good orator. And on the back of the sheet in a section entitled Fears, I put that I won't achieve anything. That when I die, I'll have no legacy. And no children. Oh, didn't know I felt that way. I would love kids. Oh, that's quite sad, isn't it? I do worry I'm running out of time. But then I hear, you know, people have had kids late in life. Not even in a relationship, though. I did send my ex, Davina I got her to look over it, needed a woman's perspective, said that it was a beautiful email to send to her next, that I never got any closure or any kind of post-mortem with. I really, really loved her. I still do love her. I know it's not, I said in there, like, you know, most of me hopes that I've been relegated to a footnote in your past and you've moved on and you're happy, and I really do mean that. I just had a lingering thing of, like, because we just completely, like, just our any kind of relationship just ceased, not seen or heard from her since, we both blocked each other online and that, I just had a lingering feeling in the back of my head that like, did she think I just didn't care? I mean, she ended it, but I don't know. Also, I need to brag about the fact I've got a Penguin book deal, so fuck you, you fucking bitch. I'm only joking. She's not a fucking bitch. I'm only joking. I really, really, really am joking. But I did also include that in the email, so you have to question my motives. No, it was, I wrote out. Anyway, I haven't heard back. I don't expect to. I said I kind of didn't want to send it, so I didn't want to re-enter a life unprompted and upturn it in any way, but it's an email. Oh god, just got a real feeling, got a feeling of sadness just came overwhelmed me then. Maybe it was the wrong thing to send an email. I mean, Davina said it was very lovely and respectful. Anyway, the following day in the ATP, in the addiction diary, I obviously downgraded my priorities. Mild panic. This was written in the diary. Mild panic because I ran out of mini eggs. They've become a replacement drugs. And now I've substituted mini eggs with chain bathing. I keep having baths. Plus, underneath gratitude list, I wrote, I'm grateful for the continuity and the structure of the weekly timetable. On Thursday, the 5th of January 2017, I got the right year this time, I'm a lot more addled and manic. It starts with an apology. Sorry about any extraneous detail. And then furls into a nutty little essay that fluctuates between Da Vinci used to channel latent homosexuality into prolific workmanship, and I've replaced mini eggs with baths. I've replaced mini eggs and baths with apples. I ate six in a row as soon as I woke up and sellotaped the cores together to make a little tower, kind of like Nan's totems that she's made. I dread going to AANA meetings, I write, as the tedium drains the small deposits of good feeling I generate throughout the day. I resent that some people have a need to mythologize or add filigree to their backstory. And then an aside, says the Ponce, who uses words like filigree and mythologize. Back to me in the diary. You have, say, Marlon Brando, I continue. Marlon Brando, the normal man. He spits, he shits, he shaves. Then you have a cinematic or literary Brando. He's shamanic. He has shamanic qualities. He's insane. For me, when people do this at meeting, it's the addict self. The drunks need to create a folk tale out of the most desperate parts of his life rather than admitting how squalid it was. A narcotic addict who wants a heightened technicolor existence. The people at these meetings I find most inspiring are the ones who seem authentic, completely undiluted, no additives. The tired woman who says, it's been fucking shit day. I love my kids, right? But today I hated my kids. But she's clean. She's still managed to stay clean. Then back to me. Apologies if this is self-indulgent, but reading this back, I clock that I'm moaning about myself, my own need to add filigree and self-mythologize, and I'm striving for the lack of artifice I see in the kind of men and women I work alongside or share an NA meeting with. Feminist theorist Sheila Robotham wrote in 2008, regarding her work with the Cleaners Action Group in the 1970s, a class gulf existed between our lives and those of the cleaners. We were nearly all young, bouncy, in our 20s. The reality of the women's lives was remote from us, and feminist historian Sally Alexander, while actually working with Jean, Annie, Elsie, Pat and Daisy of the CAG, of the Cleaners Action Group, wrote, "The dreary round of housework interspersed with a menial job during the day, then more housework all night for a pittance, with no sleep all week, aroused our sympathy and concern." Now, Jenny Turner, in an essay entitled Dark Emotions about the UK women's liberation movement and a documentary, Night Cleaners, which focuses on these low-paid women who struggle to unionise in spite of tiredness, isolation, a total lack of interest for the transport and general workers' union, relays scenes from the film. "The doctor told me to pack it in," says Annie, "smoking and sweating through obvious exhaustion. I suppose my body is tired, affecting my heart and my weight. The women had to work," they said, "because their husbands didn't bring home enough money to keep the children, and they had to do nights because they had children and housework by day. No woman does night cleaning unless she's really got to," Elsie says. There's a lot of broken marriages, you know, among night cleaners. I suppose you found that out, didn't you? You see, they're tired. They don't want to know their husband, and all they want to do is sleep. Like, they don't want to be bothered with anybody. Just the way you get, isn't it? Aside from seeing my mum in this portrait, who isn't in a loveless marriage but worked nights when we were kids, it really evokes the eroded spirit and sleep deprivation of a care home workforce. In the nook of the CTM's office, they'd sit clutching flasks of coffee at 6:30 a.m., a spectral glaze upon their face as they're submerged in the half-consciousness of an early start. Patronising as it is, there must be something I find aspirational about this, or at least a pleasing divergence away from my own wankiness and the private school elitism you see in some parts of the comedy industry, but not enough for me to openly admit, yes, this is me. Being a low-paid care worker is part of my identity. That's just what I'm on at the moment. Do you know what? Next one of these, I won't read out anything I'm doing. I don't know if you prefer me talking off the cuff or reading out, but that's what you get for today. I hope you enjoyed it, and massive love to you all. Patreon.com/ Pope Lonergan, and on the 10th of March at 7 p.m. via Next Up, I've helped to organise, but I only tell this to you, so I'm a Quaker and I don't want to be seen to capitalise on the discourse around Jewish identity, but I've helped to organise a panel with David Baddiel and some incredible Jewish comedians, and it will be chaired by Davina, by my good friend Davina Bentley, at 7 p.m, 10th of March, Next Up, and tickets will be available soon, so keep an eye out for that. See you later.